members of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and they will be discussing their solution to climate change, hosted by Craig Lubo. But first, I'm naturally with your headline news. CleanTechnica.com reports, the global fossil fuel divestment campaign continues apace, with the University of Hawaii agreeing to divest from coal, oil, and gas companies, making it the largest university to do so. The University of Hawaii Board of Regents voted this week to divest the university's $66 million endowment, following a report provided by a university-appointed group tasked with investigating the complete divestment from fossil fuels. UH Board of Regents Chair Randy Moore said, quote, the divestment task group was comprised of faculty, students, administrators, and board members. The result was a superb collaborative effort, and the final outcome represented the best of shared governance, end quote. The task group on divestment and sustainability made several recommendations, primarily a recommendation towards divesting from fossil fuels, as well as a second proposal reinforcing the university's commitment to sustainability. The news comes hot on the heels of divestment plans announced by British universities Oxford and Edinburgh, as well as French insurance giant AXA. EcoWatch.com reports, with the marching crowd stretching as far as the eye can see in downtown St. Paul, Minnesota on Saturday, thousands of people from across the Midwest came together to protest the construction of new pipelines and other infrastructure projects, which they say will deliver only harmful climate impacts for the planet and irreparable destruction to the region, not the jobs and energy security promised by big oil companies and their political backers. Under the social media hashtag #StopTarSands, Saturday's Tar Sands Resistance March was sponsored by dozens of groups, including national and local environmental organizations, indigenous communities, and various social justice groups who all agree it will take a unified front to fight back against the pipeline companies and fossil fuel interests pushing for expanded development of tar sands, shale oil, and gas deposits and other forms of extreme energy in the region. ENN.com reports, even though there is a long way to go before electric vehicles are accepted by all motorists, there is no doubt that the Kansas City Power and Light Company is putting Kansas City on the map. The company announced very interesting and ambitious plans to install 1,001 electric vehicle charging stations across the area which it serves. This is certainly a very interesting development at a time when advances in electric vehicle battery technology are hitting the headlines, but consumers are still concerned about range anxiety. The $20 million clean charging network will consist of 1,001 charging stations, which will be able to charge two cars at a time. Not only will this encourage more electric vehicles in the region, but it will also greatly help with charging at busy times of the day. And the Missouri Department of Natural Resources Online reports, the Missouri Department of Natural Resources has awarded $157,596 to the Missouri Association of Councils of Governments to provide outreach and assistance to communities interested in assessing environmental needs and identifying local priorities and creating plans to balance environmental compliance and affordability. This funding will enable regional planning commissions and local governments to work together to address environmental issues that are important to the people who live in these communities. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Region 7, has provided funding for this project under Section 604B of the Clean Water Act. The Department of Natural Resources Water Protection Program will administer the grant funds. The department is committed to working closely with communities and businesses to assist with funding efforts that improve water quality in Missouri. For more information, visit the department's Water Protection Program online. And finally, Bridging the Gap posted on their Facebook page that they are again the recipient of an REI grant for Kansas City Wildlands. We want to congratulate them for this achievement. And now I think we have John Kerman on the line to discuss the protest in Minnesota over the weekend.
Yes, hey, I'm here.
Hey, Aaron. Hey, John. How are you?
I'm good.
Well, thanks for joining us by phone today. And what was the issue that you all were protesting up in Minnesota this weekend?
So, as listeners to the show who have been listening for a while know, the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline has gotten a lot of coverage in the national media as well as on Eco Radio, KC. But the point of this tar sands resistance march was to show that the problem is much bigger than Keystone XL. It's the tar sands itself. And there is more than one company that wants to bring this tar sands through the United States and get it to the world market. The primary focus of this march was on plans by the Enbridge, another Canadian corporation, expand an existing pipeline called the Alberta Clipper, nearly doubling its capacity to bring tar sands in to the U.S., and to replace an existing pipeline with an all-new pipeline that would then be used to ship something on the order of nearly 800,000, maybe 800,000 barrels per day of tar sands into the U.S. The really tricky thing about this is that Enbridge applied for a permit on that first pipeline, or an amendment to its permit for that first pipeline, the Alberta Clipper, with the State Department to get approval for the expansion. But because the State Department has not approved that expansion yet, they're using this tricky scheme of switching the flow of the tar sands from the Alberta Clipper north of the U.S. border over to a new section of this other pipeline, Line 3, and then once it gets south of the border segment that the State Department has explicit jurisdiction over, they're switching it back to the Alberta Clipper pipeline. They made the argument to the State Department that because they're doing this through a pipeline that already has a permit for higher capacity, that they don't need any environmental reviews, no additional approvals to do that, and the State Department accepted their argument and has been letting them do that. So we're protesting all of that and the tar sands itself, which we just need to not only block the increased production from, but shut down just as quickly as we possibly can.
Now, John, I understand that the Midwest is a major focus of this tar sands fight because the refineries that they want to bring the tar sands oil to are located in the Midwest.
Some of them are, certainly. There's refineries in Superior, Wisconsin, and the Chicago area around Flanagan, Illinois. Cushing, Oklahoma, which is not technically the Midwest, but not too far from us. There's more refineries in the St. Louis area. So, yeah, some of this tar sand stuff is certainly coming. But because of their plans to increase capacity, they also want to get it to the Gulf Coast refinery so that it can be refined there and sold on the world market.
Absolutely. John, let's get some events, details about the event, about how many people were in Minnesota.
The organizers estimated that over 5,000 people came out for the march, which is really encouraging. It's as far as I know, it's the biggest any such action or march in the Midwest on environmental issues ever. I never did an actual head count, but I think it was about 40 people went on a charter bus that departed from Wichita and picked people up in Topeka, Lawrence, Kansas City, and Cameron, Missouri, on its way to St. Paul, Minnesota for the march. And about half that probably were folks from the Kansas City metropolitan area. We were a small part of the overall number at the march. But it was important to have us there because a significant portion of this increased capacity to ship tar sands through the U.S. would come through Missouri and Kansas on its way to Oklahoma from Flanagan, Illinois. There's a couple pipelines already in service shipping some of this stuff, the Flanagan South and Spearhead South pipelines, and they would ship more through Flanagan South if all of their plans come to fruition.
So, John, you are part of the organizing group to take citizens from our area up to St. Paul?
Yes, I was. The primary organizer was Lori Lawrence with the Kansas Sierra Club, but we worked in partnership with her, we being 350KC, the group that I'm with, and also the Missouri chapter of the Sierra Club. We provided funding for this. We got additional funding from the National Sierra Club in order to keep the cost for the individual riders down to a reasonable price.
Well, thank you, John, and I just want to encourage our listeners to stay tuned in to Eco Radio because we stay in contact with people like John at 350KC and Sierra Club, and so if you didn't get to go up to the rally this time, there will be other opportunities so we can have our voice heard. Thank you for joining us, John.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to invite our guests to the show and their host, Craig Lubo.
Hey, thank you, Aaron, and this is Craig Lubo, and again, our guest tonight is Lynnae Pentagill, and she is an environmental activist. She has been, after watching Inconvenient Truth in 2006, that's when she really got involved in climate change issues. And she said it's like the T-Rex romping around in the living room. And she's been a volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby for 2 years and then joined them as a staff member. Before that, she was also with Sierra Club. And are there other environmental groups you've been in?
The Nature Conservancy and then several other nonprofits. Okay. Raised money for nonprofits most of my life.
All right. And she's from Lawrence and also has a son who is studying to be an environmental attorney. My other guest, who is a volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby, is Mary Helen Korbelick. She got involved as an environmental activist most of her life, but it started with your mother was an environmental activist herself.
That's right. That's right.
And she has been working on helping others to become aware of the problem of global warming and has written many, many letters to the editor of the Kansas City Star about global warming and climate change. And she has been recognized, I think, by the Sierra Club for your letters to the editor.
Yes, that was very nice of them. Okay. Thank you.
The issue we're going to be talking about is, well, it's what Citizens Climate Lobby does. And one of the things relates to advocacy for what is called carbon fee and dividend. But let me, Lene, let's start out this telling how Climate Citizens Lobby was organized, what the impetus for that was.
Sure.
And just general broad.
Right. Well, Craig, thanks so much for having us on tonight. And so this began, Marshall Saunders is our founder, and he is a commercial realtor, retired commercial realtor from Waco, Texas. He did a lot of work on poverty relief globally and did a lot of microcredit loans. Actually, he helped originate over 1 million microcredit loans. So when he saw the movie Inconvenient Truth, it also touched his life a bit. And he saw the projections of the rising floodwaters and saw that areas of the world where he had done a lot of anti-poverty work were going to be underwater. And all those people that were lifting themselves out of poverty were going to be struggling again. They'd be displaced by those rising sea levels. So he first got involved with Climate Reality Project and became a presenter. Marshall doesn't do anything half-heartedly. He jumped right in, was making a lot of presentations. And they were talking about a lot of actions that people could take, like switching out light bulbs and how to reduce your carbon footprint. But it struck him one evening that after he'd just given a talk and encouraged all these people to make these personal change, and then the next day he read in the paper that Congress had appropriated billions in relief for fossil fuel industries. And he realized that the solution he was working on, while helpful, definitely helpful, was not big enough for this problem. And so he thought about what could he do and looked at this, started this organization to have citizen empowerment, to reclaim our democracy. And we are primarily advocating the solution of carbon fee and dividend, where you place a... Well, do you want to get into that first or just stop there, the story?
Well, let's go ahead and talk about the carbon fee and dividend.
Okay. All right. So, and everything I say, like if you don't catch it the first time, you can look at our website, citizensclimatelobby.org. There'll be a lot of great information there. So, but basically, it's a pretty simple solution in that you place a price on carbon pollution. We're advocating $15 a ton for carbon emitted the first year and then $10 a ton additionally each subsequent year. Then you return all that money back to U.S. households. And so it's going to send a very clear, consistent market signal that we're moving away from fossil fuels to non-fossil fuel energy sources. That's going to direct not only consumers, but also industry to make change in their business modeling, because those fossil fuels are going to become more and more expensive. So it's also revenue neutral. It's not a regulatory approach, which helps it be appealing to both to conservatives, since it's not a big government solution. And it's also very, very effective. So we commissioned a study by an independent firm called RIMI, which stands for Regional Economic Modeling Inc. And all this information is also on our website. And RIMI is over 30 years old. It's very well respected. It's done studies for Ernst & Young and for Tennessee Valley Authority, MIT, American Gas Association. So definitely not biased in our favor. They're unbiased. They just look at how would our solution affect both the economy and also the environment. And one thing that motivated us to take on this study is that we kept hearing you can either protect the economy or you can protect the environment. And there was this big resistance, like, well, we don't want to damage the economy. So we thought, well, let's see how bad this is. Or maybe it's not bad. Let's just see how this shakes out. And so what RIMI showed us is that it actually has a positive effect on the economy and significantly reduces CO2 emissions. So after 10 years, CO2 emissions are reduced by 33%. And after 20 years, it goes up to 52%. It also, after 10 years, adds 2.1 million jobs to the economy and $70 to $85 billion to our GDP.
And now, to reduce that by, you said, 33%, isn't that mainly relying on the idea that the carbon fee is going to discourage consumption and get people to voluntarily reduce their gas usage?
Right. Well, there's a strong economic incentive. So to get an idea of how that affects us, so a $15 per ton fee equates to about 15 cents extra at the gas pump per gallon. So after 2 years, you'd put that additional $10, it would be 25 cents more. So it's not drastic. It won't cause our economy to come to a screeching halt, but it'll be a very clear, consistent price signal. And, you know, it's been a while, but I remember just, what was it, a couple years ago when gas was over $4 a gallon. Everybody I knew made changes in their behavior. And these are people who could care less about the environment. It's just not on their radar. But they were taking less errands. They were carpooling. They were walking because that price signal caught their attention. It's the one thing we all pay attention to is our wallet and how it affects us. So if you see that gas is going up and say you're getting ready to buy a new car and you're deciding between a Prius and a Hummer, you've got a clear signal that that Hummer is going to get really, really expensive and it might behoove you to invest in a Prius. I'm doing a lot of talking.
Mary Helen,
do you want to add to all this?
No, I agree with you. I think that RIMI report was really shows exactly what happens with when we do have a price on carbon and so I think it's something that we really need to do. We need to let the world know or let people know how important this is. And I think money wise people are going to see that it really pays off to have a fee and dividend.
Two questions on that. First of all, have you seen any studies? I'll ask you the question, and then we'll go to a break.
Okay.
And have you answer.
Good, so we can think about it. Great.
Have there been studies that document that, like when the gas companies raised the prices, that consumption on a national level or even a global level, that it declined? So let's take a break for a minute, and then we'll come back and have you answer that.
This Tuesday at 6 p.m. is Transit Talk on Radioactive Magazine. Host Janet Rogers talks with Lou Austin, Karen Clausen, and Chuck Ferguson about the region's response to our inability to get to 82% of the jobs in the Kansas City region by transit. Join us Tuesday at 6 p.m. on Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
principles of this transition are very clear. We have to be grounded in the science. We have to be guided by the science, which means we need to keep around 3/4 of the proven fossil fuel reserves in the ground. We can get to 100% renewable energy by 2030 or 2040, according to the best research out of Stanford University, and we need to do it. It needs to be a democratic process. We need an energy system that does not create sacrifice zones. We can power our economies without poisoning anyone.
That's Naomi Klein on Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
Traveling through time and space on today's current cast. Ever touch something older than the sun? Well, take a dip in the ocean and you can say you have. According to astronomist Edwin Bergen, a researcher at the University of Michigan, some of the water on Earth was originally interstellar ice that predates our solar system.
That tells you that all planetary systems are provided with abundant water at their birth, which has very interesting implications when you think about the fact that water is the liquid of life on our planet.
This research not only supports the potential of life on other planets, it underscores how little is known about water here at home. For example, how much is trapped deep inside the Earth. Support for Current Cast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Okay, this is Craig Lubo, and we are back with Mary Helen Korbelek and Lene Pentegel, and they are with the Citizens Climate Lobby, and we are talking about primarily the issues relating to carbon fee dividend and related issues. So I posed a question to you before the break about what studies, if any, document that. And what I'm thinking is that, you know, if somebody is driving around the gas guzzler and they're buying a car that only gets 20 miles to the gallon, how is 15 cents per gallon going to make a difference? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how is that going to make a difference more than just the normal increase in gas prices?
Right. Well, and we've hit my first question that I don't have the answer to, so I don't know if there's national studies. It seems like there probably are. We were talking before the show, doing this work, I'm a lot of times out of my comfort zone, and it's hard for me to keep up with all the information. Something like this, if somebody really wants to know the answer, if you want to just send us an email, we'll get that answer back to you. And that's kind of how we handle things, too, when we're meeting with members of Congress, because a lot of times, I mean, this is a very complicated subject, but it's okay. Most of our volunteers, they're doing this on top of very busy lives, and members of Congress are so impressed that you are taking the time to come meet with them that they're very understanding. We just get back with them. So I'll get back with you. I'll get back with anybody who wants that. But I would say, you know, part of this is dependent on consumer choices. And I mean, just anecdotally, I have seen a lot of those switches that people do pay attention to their pocketbook. So I believe that does happen, and I bet there are studies that back it up. But also, I think, as we touched on before, this is not only affecting personal choices, but industries are going to be paying attention to this. So again, if they see that there's going to be this clear, consistent market signal that fossil fuels are going to become more and more expensive, then they know. So, like, Ford is going to be putting more development into hybrids and high-efficiency cars, and they're going to know we're going to go. I remember in the news that truck sales fell off dramatically when those gas prices were up high. And so part of it's going to be you go car shopping, and there's just going to be a lot more options that are going to keep all this in mind. And Westar, you know, that supplies Lawrence with our electricity, as they see that this clear, consistent market signal is going to be out there, they're going to look at their portfolio planning ahead and say, oh, you know what? It is going to make more and more sense to add wind to our portfolio. So I feel comforted knowing that we're going to get price signals both for the consumers but also business. And it's really exciting, too, to think about what's going to come with this. Climate change, there's a lot of it that's dark and depressing, but there's also a lot that's really exciting. And when you've got these incentives and you've got entrepreneurs and investors that are sitting on the sideline right now because they don't know what's going to happen. But if, when, I'm going to say when, our legislation gets passed, they are going to know what's going to happen. And there's going to be a lot of movement into research, development, innovation. And it's going to be really exciting to see what happens.
Okay. Now,
I'd like to add something. We were talking about cars. I have noticed that there are a lot more small cars on the road. I really noticed this because I noticed the Priuses. I used to own a Prius, and I see a lot of Priuses, and I see a lot of small, very small cars. So I think people are really, really trying to use less fuel and trying to save money. Don't you think so, Lene?
I do, Mary Helen.
In terms of the mechanics of the fee, that we go into the price of the gasoline. Now, in terms of impact, though, how are you going to minimize the impact on people who are living in poverty?
Okay, good question.
Who have jobs where they can barely get to work, and some of these people might be driving cars that are 15 years old because they can't afford a new car.
Right.
So,
that's
of course,
true.
Those are not
that's
fuel
true.
Efficient.
Yeah, right.
So how do you help those people so that they don't lose their jobs?
Right. Well, under this model, two-thirds of us will either break even or receive more back in our monthly dividend check than we're going to pay for the increased cost of goods and energy. And the poor, de facto, are living a low-carbon footprint lifestyle. They don't have multiple locations. They don't have vacation homes. They're not jet-setting around the world. So they are going to come out ahead. That dividend check is going to be more than what they're paying. So that's one thing a lot of our members are very passionate about, and why they're so committed to this solution, because it does protect the poor and the middle class. It's just that top third that will be feeling it more than the others, but there's more money up there, and it's not going to be an adverse effect for them.
Okay, and so to clarify, then, you're saying the dividend checks, they would get that back on a monthly basis, so they wouldn't have to wait and file an income tax return at the end of the year.
Right.
And so if that's done that way, how do they and they're going to be thinking that they're going to get that back.
Mm-hmm.
And that would apply not just people at the low end, but people at the high end, if they're going to get a dividend check. Aren't they going to think that, well, I'm going to get that back, so I don't need to conserve, possibly?
Possibly, but to me it's a lot more fun to spend money on something other than electricity and gas. And I think there's some other consumers that will be excited in what that allowed them to do. But again, it's going to be partly consumer choices, but also partly what's offered by businesses. But take, for example, a homeowner who's looking at possibly insulating their home. And say before carbon fee and dividend is passed, it would be a 15-year payback. But then once that legislation is passed, they say, oh my gosh, it's a 7-year payback. I am going to jump in. I'm going to make this investment. Or someone thinking about putting solar panels on their house. And again, that payback period drops down drastically. So a lot of folks, they're already, I mean, solar's just hopping right now. In Lawrence, Kansas, there's a lot of homes with solar on. And as that becomes more and more competitive pricing, more and more folks are going to jump in and embrace those solutions and be part of that.
Okay. And so the carbon fee, just to clarify, would apply to electric consumption and not just gasoline.
The fee is applied at the source. So as the coal comes out of the ground, as the oil pumps out of the ground, or as it is imported into our country. And that's one thing that's really...
It's all fossil fuels, isn't it?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that's really elegant about the solution. It's very simple. You just have that one time that the fee is assessed. And then, so Exxon, for example, is going to pass that price increase on to their consumers. And again, we're hoping that that price signal is going to cause some changes in consumer behavior, and then even more significantly encourage businesses to change their modeling some.
And we do have a question from a caller.
More of a comment, but I think soliciting your comment, The caller said he certainly agrees with most of what he's hearing tonight, but some things to be concerned about: lithium, and that that make up lithium ion batteries are mined primarily near the Serengeti, and as a result of that, they're going inland before, and so there's a highway that cuts across, going all the way to the ocean. Now, that's what the caller said. One other thing I would add to that is that it's affecting the migration of, I don't remember whether it's some kind of elk or something like that, or antelope, that is one of the only really migrating mammals that herd like that. And so that's one comment the caller made, which I footnoted. And then the other comment, when you're talking about copper, and I think what he was saying is that there's a lot of copper in a hybrid vehicle as well, that must be, copper must be smelt, which takes fossil fuels to do that. So there are some...
Right, and I think this is a... We live in a very complicated world, and there's no perfect solution. Mm. I started off as a volunteer with this work because after doing personal research, but then also seeing this is what Dr. James Hansen endorses. He's on our advisory board. Mm-hmm. Quite a few other people that I really trust their judgment that know a whole lot more than I do, they're putting their lot behind this solution because it appears to be the most effective solution. Yeah, there's going to be some negative side effects as well. But, I mean, I do, probably everyone listening to this show right now does a lot of eco-guilt. And just by the mere existence of our lives, mm-hmm. we are harming the environment. But it's not really an option for us to go away. Mm-hmm. So here we are, these creatures that are wreaking havoc to large or small degree. And so we make the best decisions that we can. And none of us are living a perfect life. I mean, it's just impossible. And some of us are choosing not to eat meat, and some of us are choosing not to drive, and some of us are choosing whatever. Mm-hmm. So if there is a better solution out there, then I am all for it. This is by far the best thing I have seen as far as reducing CO2 emissions, and we've got to do something. Inaction is not an option. I mean, we should be at 350 parts per million or less. We're over 400. So...
Well, this caller suggested that perhaps alcohol-fueled vehicles might be a solution, be made from, from bio. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's something I can't really speak intelligently about, so I won't.
Okay.
But I appreciate his ideas, and so many people are giving a lot of great thought, and I like I said before, I am really excited to see what breakthroughs in technology and innovation we have. What's this world going to look like in 10 years? Some people are completely overwhelmed by that prospect and get scared by the predictions of climate change. I mean, it scares me too, and that's why I do this work. I mainly got into it looking at my son and thinking, what can I do to make sure this world is as good as it can be for him? I was a single mom at the time. I had, still am, and I had 3 part-time jobs. I had really no free time. And it didn't feel like I had the time to do this work. But I looked at him and the other children of our world, all across the world, and it's like, we have to find the time and we have to figure this out. It's not an option to leave this for somebody else to do.
Well, and then I have grandchildren, and I'm wondering what's going to happen. What will the world be like for them and for their children? So we have to think of the future generations with these emissions, and we need to get emissions down.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It used to be, as we thought about this topic, it was only our concern for our children and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Now it's looking like it's us.
That's right. That's right.
And, everybody sees it now. It's, again, this is a really difficult topic. For so long, it was this abstract concept, and we didn't see the effects of it right every day. But now... it's there. If you're a gardener, which is pretty mainstream, but the back of the seed packages has changed.
Because the zones, where the planting zones have moved north.
Yeah.
In fact, animals are moving toward the poles. The animals are migrating to the North Pole and to the South Pole to get away from the heat.
Right, and I spend a lot of time in California. That's where our organization is headquartered. And, boy, in California, this is forefront everybody's mind because of the water implications. And NASA just came out with a study about a month ago showing that in a year, all the water reserves, unless something drastically changes, all the water reserves are going to be empty that are providing water for California.
And these are underground reserves that they're drawing on right now.
Well, the lakes, the reserves has been what's been providing drinking water, but the underground water is what agriculture has been used.
And they're
but
using
they're going to have to
up.
Switch over to that for water, and then it's like, well, what happens to agriculture?
You mentioned the emissions, lowering the emissions before. And we're really talking about more than just climate change, because we talk about health impacts of those same emissions that cause problems, whether it's asthma. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, asthma has gone up a lot.
Do you want to read the statistic you brought from the Remy report about the number of lives saved?
Yes.
Can you find that?
Okay.
This is again from the Remy study.
Air quality has, in 20 years... Air quality will, if we do the Remy report where we cut emissions, in 20 years, there will be 230,000 premature deaths avoided over the 20 years
okay.
if we cut the emissions.
So that's significant.
That's
very
a lot.
Significant.
And that's national or...
I think
global. Okay.
Probably.
All right.
And again, these all this information is on our website. This the Remy report has a separate tab that's lots of great information.
Okay.
That's REMI.
Yeah.
Remy.
All right. And let's move. We have a national conference coming up. So
we
tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's just really, really exciting about this work is it is definitely citizen empowerment. And you might be listening to this program concerned about climate change, thinking, well, what can I as one person do? And the answer to that is you can do amazing things. And our volunteers, it's beautiful to watch the process as they come in, and some don't even know what the word constituent means. And then with training and empowerment and the support that they get through our process, they're out there meeting with editorial boards of major newspapers and meeting with members of Congress. And one of the most exciting things we do all year is we come to Washington, D.C. once a year. We have education and training for our volunteers the first day, and then we go out and we lobby all the members of Congress and talking to them about this solution to climate change and then also the risk of not acting on this issue. So we're going to have nearly 900 volunteers coming from all across the U.S. and abroad, and we'll probably be meeting with almost every congressional office.
And that's in June?
June 23rd.
Okay.
And then the day before that is our congressional call-in. And this is a way for everyone to be able to participate in this process. And again, this information is on our homepage. You just scroll down a little bit and you'll see the details. But the thought is that people from home will be calling in the day before we lobby and just letting our members of Congress know that we're concerned about this and we want action. Because our leaders don't lead us. They actually are waiting for us to tell them what to do. And so we, the people, actually lead our leaders to the solution. If we tell them this is what we want and they hear from enough of us, then they will take action. I believe that, I mean, there's definitely a lot of money involved in this issue, but I believe they're not hearing from enough people yet. They're hearing more and more from folks. And
they hear more from the oil and gas people, from the oil and coal people. And don't they get subsidies, the oil people?
Right, but I think more and more people are becoming involved in this process, and they're hearing more
yeah.
and more.
Yeah.
We're going to a break.
Yes, we
okay. I want to say more when we come back about that congressional
okay.
call-in.
All right.
On this week's All Souls Forum, the primary election for the city council is over. The general election will be held on June 23rd. Who will you vote for? Hear the candidates debate the issues on this Wednesday's All Souls Forum at 6 p.m.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 2 years ago, visitors to a chateau in Nantes, France, peered over the side of the moat at something disturbing. Lifelike sculptures of businessmen, partially submerged in the water below. With bored expressions on their faces, the clay figures appeared to be passively watching the water rise around them.
You sense the water there. You see it. You can imagine yourself in sea level rise. And that's very different than from saying, oh, yes, the sea level is going to rise, you know, 3 feet by 2050 or something like that. It's really a different experience.
That's Marta Kern, director of EcoArts Connections, a U.S. nonprofit that brings artists and scientists together to communicate environmental issues. She explains why the exhibition called Waiting for Climate Change by Isaac Cordal was so powerful.
One of the difficulties of climate change has been that it's relatively slow moving. The images that have been given often are very distant. You know, the polar bear is far away. And so it's easy for people to think, oh, it's not here. It's not me. It's not my responsibility.
But Kern believes public art can give people a powerful experience, making climate change more personal and tangible while inspiring action. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, this is Craig Luba, and we are back with Mary Helen Korbeluk and Lynette Pentagel from Citizens Climate Lobby. Lynette, you said you wanted to know something you wanted to.
Yeah, just a little bit more about that congressional call-in. I'm really excited about this. And it was fun. As we walked into lobby last year, they all had heard from us. They said, we got a lot of calls yesterday. And that helped us so much as we were going into those one-on-one meetings that they had heard from so many people. It got their attention, and we were just set up perfectly. So I would encourage everyone listening who's at all concerned about this to go to our website, please, and sign up to make a call. And then if you're so inclined, if you would post on your social media or email out to your friends, this is a simple action. It gives you some script. You don't need to be an expert on climate change. All you need to say is, I want action on this. I'm concerned about this. It's time to take care of this. If you want to read our proposal and feel inclined to suggest carbon fee and dividend, great. But that's not what we're asking. We just want people to let their members of Congress know that this is of concern. So you just go to our website, sign up. You'll get a reminder. You'll get some tips on what you could say. And the more people we have calling in, the more successful we're going to be lobbying. So,
and there's many different solutions if we can get Congress to act.
Right, right. Okay. And, you know, like, cap and trade is another solution. That's our second favorite option. We feel like this one's more efficient, but, you know, I appreciate those folks working on cap and trade. I appreciate, you know, John, who led the tar sands effort, and 350.org. All these people are doing different aspects of raising awareness on this issue and have these different solutions. I just feel like this one's the best, but it's not like I don't appreciate all these other efforts. I really do. And there's a lot of people coming together. This is becoming more and more of a concern as those, the effects of climate change are becoming more and more tangible.
All right. And part of that conference, I just want you to mention, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, so
Catherine,
I'll let
Hayhoe?
Okay, she is, yeah. Catherine Hayhoe.
She is amazing. She's a very well-respected, well-known climate scientist. She's also an evangelical Christian and is married to a minister. And it's great. Her voice is heard in different segments of population that we haven't been able to reach before. And, you know, the faith community is coming forward so strongly now with messages concerned about this. And the, you know, this really is a faith-based issue.
Well, I saw her on Bill Moyers just about a year ago, and she really made a very compelling argument about how faith community needs to be involved in, mm-hmm. and that it's in their faith to be supporting and protecting the environment.
Right. I think the main point, if you're a spiritual person, if you believe in God, that we've been given this planet and we have a responsibility to take care of this and the creatures here, and not only humans, but a whole bunch of other creatures who are all being adversely affected.
And that's what Pope Francis has been addressing this issue now.
Right. He's been great. Some really strong statements. And then the Pope's encyclical will be coming out June 18th, just a few days before our conference. And if you haven't heard of that before, it's a very strong statement from the Pope himself saying, urging us to act on climate change. And there are a lot of Catholics, and that's going to have a big effect on these discussions. There's a lot of members in Congress who are Catholic. The Pope's encyclical is going to speak to them. It will make a difference.
Well, and not only Catholics will pay attention to him, a lot of us Protestants will pay attention to him. I think it's very important for all faiths to take care of the planet that God has given us. And there's a sustainable sanctuary group of churches that are trying to have sustainable churches.
Yeah.
And they're working to cut down on the use of power and
yeah,
to...
Yeah, the faith community's really jumped
in
strongly.
Yes, very much so.
And that has changed the discussion.
Right.
Okay. And Mary Helen, what do, as a volunteer, what do the volunteers do on a regular basis?
Oh, the volunteers meet once a month, the first Saturday of every month, and we hear a telephone call. It's a national call from Citizens Climate Lobby about how to get emissions down and how to reach out to other people. And anyway, actions that I've done.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the clock. We have just a few minutes.
Well,
I want them to know what you've done. And
I have written letters to the editor. I haven't written a. You can write a an editorial to the paper. You can call radio stations like KKFI, KCUR. You can call them. You can do all kinds of things.
Some outreach events and meeting with editorial boards, papers, and then meeting with our members of Congress.
That's right.
At home and in D.C.
And then you can reach out to your friends to join Citizens Climate Lobby. We need more members, and we have grown a lot, haven't we?
Oh, we have. We double or triple in size every year.
Every year, mm-hmm. Double or triple.
Yeah,
that's wonderful.
And do you have a Facebook page too?
We do. Citizens okay. Climate Lobby, yeah.
All right.
We're easy to find. Google us and you'll find us for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've met with in the past, with local Congress people.
Sure. We have on both sides of the state line in Kansas and Missouri.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And without specifying mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. is supporting what, mm-hmm. Have they been generally receptive? Are you making mm-hmm. progress in convincing them about mm-hmm. any of this?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Don't you think they have been? The ones I've been to, with
uh-huh.
you.
Well, and I'd say, you know, a big part of our work is we show up with respect and gratitude. And we look for a place to connect honestly with this member of Congress. What can we share with them that we appreciate, either a vote or... their service to the country. And when you start a meeting off like that, it creates a positive atmosphere. And when you meet year after year with that attitude of respect and gratitude, these relationships have warmed up quite a bit. And some of the offices started off a tad bit adversarial. I'd say there's not an office in Kansas or Missouri that we can't walk in and have a really nice discussion.
We've got about 45 seconds left. One real quick question I wanted to ask is, we mm-hmm. talked about the economy before.
Mm-hmm.
What's a prediction on the job market as far as jobs, green jobs being created?
Well, I know that I can't give you a figure on the jobs. I know that per million in output, that renewables have employed quite a bit more people than fossil fuels. And that source is also listed on our website. But I also know from the RIMI report that dividend that's going back to U.S. households acts as a stimulant to the economy. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting the right word, but you know, more money in your pocket, so you spend more. And so that is what's adding that 2.1 million jobs to the economy, okay. And that's what's adding that 70 to $85 billion to our GDP.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. For those who just joined us, you've been listening to Lynnae Pentagill, and Mary Helen Korbelek, and we were talking about Climate Citizens Lobby. For those of you who missed part of the program, we do podcast the show, so you can go back on and listen to it later.
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you, Craig.
All right, this is Natural Lee, and I have your events for the upcoming weeks. On June 10th from 4 to 6 p.m., the Environmental Management Commission promotes environmental awareness and resource efficiency to Kansas City leaders and staff to assist the progress of the city towards sustainability. The general public is encouraged to attend and observe meetings and to join and participate in its efforts. The meetings are held the second Wednesday of each month. So this meeting is from 4 to 6 p.m. on Wednesday, June 10th, at the Mid-America Regional Council, Rivergate Center, 600 Broadway, second floor in Kansas City, Missouri. And on June 14th, from 2 to 4 p.m., there is a herbal first aid class where you can learn how to use herbal remedies and prepare a first aid kit. Easy recipes will be provided, and you will learn how to make everything from natural bug repellent to treating minor cuts. And you can find more information about this class by visiting prairiemagicherbals.com. Registration is required by June 11th. And the Kansas City Sweet Potato Project will be planting sweet potatoes in front of the Central Patrol Division at 1200 East Linwood. Mark your calendars. Limited number of sweet potato slips available. First come, first serve. Again, that is June 11th at 10 a.m. And the Kansas City Sweet Potato Project can be found on Facebook. And lastly, Heather Flores, author of Food Not Lawns, How to Turn Your Lawn into a Garden and Your Neighborhood into a Community, and Food Not Lawns Kansas City, offer this urban permaculture primer in the form of a three-day workshop. They're calling it a Lawn Liberation Workshop, and it's from June 25th to June 27th, and they will be teaching Urban Permaculture 101. And you can, it takes place at the Cultural Center at 3504 Woodland Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri, 64109 from June 25th to 27th. And also this event has been posted on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. And that is all for our events.
Thank you very much, Natural E. And do stay tuned for Sabor Latino with special guest host Viviana right after This Week in Water.
In times of drought, men marry for water. That and other stories for the week ending June 7th, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Last week, the Environmental Protection Agency released a draft assessment of the effects fracking has on water. Even though the draft report is very long, one of its major problems is the lack of data the EPA can obtain mainly from oil and gas companies.
While the agency didn't find what it called widespread or systemic impacts to drinking water, it did show specific cases of water contamination.
The EPA noted that there were instances in which well integrity and wastewater management affected drinking water sources, but that the number was small relative to how many wells had been fracked across the country.
The EPA study notes a major deficiency in its own ability to review the industry's effect on drinking water. Little information is being collected about water wells and aquifers before and during the fracking process.
The EPA also noted that drillers would not list all of the chemicals they used at about 70% of the wells studied. Withholding this information makes it impossible to do an adequate study.
In other words, if the companies won't disclose what they're using when fracking, then how could a homeowner or scientist know what to look for in nearby water sources?
The EPA's report is now open for comments. However, due to the lack of adequate information, no one should expect or claim any level of certainty from the report about the impact of fracking on water supplies.
As we mentioned last week, India is facing a record-breaking heat wave. Hundreds of people have died from dehydration and heat stroke.
Making matters worse, the hoped-for monsoon season, which typically brings much-needed relief for residents and farmers, is forecast to be weaker than average.
That could be disastrous for the country, and especially in Maharashtra, India's third largest state, where the government recently estimated that more than 19,000 villages have no access to tap water.
Finding drinking water often means a walk to a well or other source in sweltering heat, plus waiting in line, which can take hours.
How to survive? According to Danish Siddiqui of Reuters, the answer is to get a water wife. Or two, or three if necessary.
Men in this barren part of western India are taking on extra wives for the sole purpose of fetching water.
Polygamy is illegal in India, but in these dusty villages, water wives are common because collecting water is extremely time-consuming and inconvenient.
The men spend long hours as day laborers in nearby farms, so getting water for a household is a job in itself, more than what one wife can handle on top of cooking and caring for children.
The water wives are often widowed or single mothers, so the arrangement, which is in name only, works for them. They typically have their own living space, and as one woman interviewed for the story said, they feel like sisters.
Many people, including us, thought that the cause of sea level rise is due solely to melting glaciers, but this may not be the whole story.
The properties of the water compound H2O make it react to temperature in strange ways.
If you freeze it, the water molecule expands. Then if you warm it to about 40 degrees Fahrenheit, it contracts. Warm it further, it expands again.
According to a report last week in Business Insider, it's the expansion of water as it heats up that's contributing to coastal flooding in areas such as New Orleans.
The Earth's surface has warmed up about 1.5 degrees since 1880 and has had major consequences. The oceans have absorbed much of this heat, which has caused their volume to expand.
Right now, that expansion is only a small fraction of the original volume of the oceans, but according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, sea levels rose about 8 inches from 1880 to 2009. They say that thermal expansion is the predominant cause, which is made worse by melting ice.
Any increase in sea levels, even 8 inches, can lead to more flooding from storm surges and cause damage to levees, especially in vulnerable coastal cities such as Miami.
And finally this week, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Well, at least the folks in Astoria, Oregon thought so. They were running out of options for how to cope with hundreds of sea lions crowding the docks on their fishing town not far from Portland.
They tried everything. Electrified mats, chicken wire, brightly colored beach balls. Nothing worked.
That is, until someone got the brilliant idea to bring in what sea lions fear most. Orcas.
And luckily, a whale-watching company from nearby Washington State just happened to have a 32-foot promotional boat shaped like an orca. It was complete with real killer whale calls, including a scary call-to-dinner song often emitted after an orca kills a sea lion or seal. Perfect.
Until it wasn't. The fake whale tried to sail to Astoria, but had engine trouble.
But not to worry. After a brief repair, the whale was off again and was within sight of the docks, and oh!
The fiberglass creature went belly up, capsized by the wake of a passing cargo ship. Phoebe Dick, as it's been mockingly named on Twitter, had to be towed to the dock where it now rests upside down.
Still, Port of Astoria Executive Director Jim Knight said the sea lions briefly got deathly silent as the orca was sailing into view, so it still might have potential
to be the butt of jokes in sea lion circles, that is.
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.